Welcome to Disneyland.
Island, episode 100.
16th of March, 2012.
There you go. On tonight's show, we have kind of less action-packed than usual, but we're going
to... Content, or quality heavy, though.
Yeah, quality over quantity. Usually it's shite, but we have loads,
loads of it.
Yeah. So, on tonight's show, we've got... later on, we have Pete the Temp coming in.
Yeah. He's going to lively us up with some.
Yeah, yeah. And we also have a few people in the studio live who are going to discuss the kind of historical and current incarnations of fascism and anti-fascism.
Yeah.
And then we've also got a bit of a discussion about neoliberalism.
And some recordings.
Yeah, fucking austerity montage, as I called the file.
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at the austerity measures being pushed through in Ireland, Spain, and Greece in particular, and kind of reflecting on what it means, trying to be a bit reflective in a political sense.
And we might have a bit of a chat about it afterwards. Hopefully we'll have some people in the studio who are more knowledgeable than us.
Yeah. And to keep fair and balanced, we've got a special guest in tonight as well.
Wait for that.
Yeah.
When's that happening?
That's before Pete the Temp. Before after the anti-fascist thing.
Cool. So we're saving all the funny stuff to the end then, yeah.
Do you want to crack a bit of funny stuff in earlier?
Maybe.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Well, while we talk about it, should we play something?
Yeah.
Well, who's our DJ tonight?
Oh yeah, we've got DJ Warlock from Ragbone.
Rag and Bone, yeah. Good stuff. I'm looking forward to it. Party time.
We had a bit of a taster there earlier on. I can just about regain my hearing now. Should I listen keenly, yeah? Cool. So do you want to say anything before we press go?
No, I think there's a little intro, so it should self-explain. Maybe we'll talk about it after.
Okay. Fucking austerity.
Well, the question points to the fact that we have a crisis. Well, I don't think we have an economic crisis. What's going on is an attack on living conditions by capital. It's basically, instead of a crisis, probably what it is the biggest transfer of public wealth into private hands. Economical crisis would mean that there is no enough money around, there is no enough liquidity, as they call it, to pay for services, for example, or it would mean that there is no possibility of creating wealth or producing wealth. This is crap. There is a lot of money. It's just use it for whatever they want.
At the moment, there is no chance of an economic recovery in Greece. It's not on the horizon. The recession there has been going on for a few years, and it's getting worse. Economists, I noticed this weekend, are starting to talk about a possibility of 15 years of recession in Greece. Although on the mainstream media, you will see talk of we're doing this so there's a recovery. The economists and the academics actually pretty well understand that's not going to be happening. The talk of recovery is a carrot, if you like, and to be used to get Greeks to give up their living standards. In reality, when they talk amongst themselves, they know that's not likely to be happening anytime soon. The aim of it is to bring about a new heightened level of exploitation of the working class in Greece, set up a testing ground really for the rest of Europe and other parts of the world to set an example, a benchmark of how to reduce a population to more or less destitution and to repress the inevitable resistance that comes along. Apart from that kind of ideological thread, there's also self-interested actors within banking elites who just want to make more money for themselves, and they believe that this restructuring of the Greek economy is setting themselves up for long-term profit. Capitalism, as it normally is understood, i.e. people or businesses making profits and losses based on trading commodities is basically non-existent in Greece at the moment. Greek gross domestic product has declined by a fifth over the last few years since the onset of this crisis, and it's in such a tailspin that it's basically being abandoned by the international elite. They don't think it's possible to make any money in Greece at the moment. So they are emphasizing the long term over the short term by creating conditions for their profit in years to come, when they believe that magically the economy will fix itself. And nobody actually has much of an idea how that is going to happen. I think they're just kicking the ball down the road, really. They think it's going to happen at some point. The bankers really plan to reconstruct Greek economy entirely in their interest, so that they're able to make huge profits once the economy magically turns around under the conditions of the various bailout packages. Wages are being slashed by enormous percentages. State spending has been cut to the bone. State assets are being privatized. And professions which are regulated, such as lorry drivers in Greece, enjoyed certain protections from big business until recently, which guaranteed them a decent living. And there was a big kickoff last summer when the bankers demanded that those protections be dismantled. Greek lorry drivers went on strike, and there was talk of fuel running out in the country, and the army were brought in to force them back to work. They were basically officially conscripted into the army. So this is another form of struggle that's taking place.
The crisis doesn't exist, really. Then the recovery is not really needed, because we don't need to recover from the crisis. What they call recovery is just the second step of this so-called crisis. First, they impose it, and they bring all these austerity measures, so we can recover from this supposedly lack of money and resources and productivity and all. Recovery mainly means changing the working conditions for most people by introducing labor laws all over Europe. They're extremely neoliberal in the sense that what they mean is maximum flexibility in terms of what the worker is supposed to give to his or her job, as well as doing away with all the protections workers had been winning for the last 80, 100 years. I think the aim basically is to introduce regulations all over the place, which will mean that the good phase of capitalism as we know it, in terms of, you know, the social contract, you have to work all your life, you have to waste all your life in a workplace, but in exchange will give you holidays, paid holidays, will give you education for your kids, will give you universal health care, will give you better wages every month, so you will be able to change your car every 5 years. All this is gone.
Well, in Ireland, you see there's organisations like the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank, and they're directly interfering with how financial operations run within the state in Ireland. It could go out of control. We've seen what kind of damage, lasting damage, the International Monetary Fund has done in other countries, in South American countries. A solid example of how the distribution of wealth has been affected is by two things that the governments are introducing in Ireland, which would be the water taxes. A campaign defeated the water charges in the 90s in Ireland, and also a tax on houses. These are taxes. They're not progressive taxes. They're not going to fund local services. They're not going to fund central state. So what they're going to do is they're going to pay for the debts that bondholders and bankers have built up in this country.
It's all going in one direction, from the working class and other poor to the absolute richest, not necessarily in Greek society, but in global society. If we can talk about the neoliberal period since Thatcher in the UK, seeing a huge discrepancy and growing discrepancy between the richest and the poorest, this is that on steroids, the common term says it, that in a brutal shock treatment in a tiny period of time comparatively. If we've had 30 years to get to where we are, they're having it, and much, much worse in 5 years. Value is being taken from people's work, and it's going directly to the richest. It's also leaving Greece to a certain extent, because as the normal Greek economy is collapsing. Greek people, with their reduced pay, their reduced benefits, can't afford to put money back into the economy. So traditional, like homegrown Greek economy is collapsing. So all the money actually is leaving Greece to go to bankers in other European countries and the US. Whenever there's a new round of bailout announced by the Troika, as they're called, the European Union, European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund, it's portrayed in the corporate media as being a bailout for Greece, but hardly a cent of it stays within the borders of Greece. It goes directly now to the Greek government's creditors, while ordinary Greeks, having apparently got this great bailout, actually just suffer the bailout conditions, which is always more cuts, more cuts, more cuts. This is a debt spiral, I call it, because each set of bailout conditions deepens the recession. Ordinary Greeks have even less money to spend, more businesses collapse, the GDP figures go worse, Greek government has less money to spend because it's getting less taxes in, it owes more money, and it's just going on and on. There doesn't seem to be a way out of it.
In Spain, only a month ago, in February, for example, they passed a new working laws, which had been debated in Parliament for a long time. But since the right wing, the Conservatives, came into power a few months ago, you know, and they got majority in Parliament, so they were able to implement and to pass it through Parliament without any problems. And it's the most radical reform ever, I think, in any European state that I know. I think it's even harder than in Greece, in terms of what it has been approved. For example, sacking the workforce is now completely free for any employer, whilst before they had to actually pay some payout money. When the employer thinks that they will not make as much profit as they thought they would, that's already a legal reason for sacking someone. And there is another a way of sacking, which is as long as the company can show that they have been making less profits for 2 quarters in a row, not making loss, but actually making less profit than before. That's another reason why people can be sacked. For example, they introduce flexibility, maximum flexibility. The employer now can decide your working conditions will be depending on how much profit they make. So if they think that they are not making enough, they may want to change your working patterns, your timetable, your actual work, what you actually been employed to do, it may change at any time. So all these things making work completely precarious, you need to be able to be completely flexible. And it basically what it is introducing the conditions which you normally see in cash in hand, that in Spain is called black market, working for cash in hand, for money in your pocket. Those conditions are now being legalized as the main conditions for legal working. Contracts don't exist anymore. They say that in order to have a recovery, you have to introduce these really hard regulations for everyone, which bring people into kind of in a state of shock.
I have a fear that the worst type of capitalism could come out of the sort of what you could call the ashes of the crisis, which I don't really believe is fully over or is hit hardest yet. But if you look at countries like Italy or Greece, which now have unelected or appointed leaders in their country, which are financial interests, not interests of the majority of the population, these are autocratic. It's autocratic capitalism, and it's a scary thought.
Have finally understood that representative democracy is a sham. It's not even worth the name, and that people in parliaments are just there to serve their own interests and the interests of their class. So in this sense, I think crisis of representation is a very positive thing. And in Spain, since people took to the streets last May and occupied hundreds of squares and all the assemblies that came out of that, one of the main things, and one, you know, they say one of the main slogans is no one represents us, and that's directed specifically to politicians. None of you represented you, and it links a bit like to, you know, to the Argentinian. So I think at least that's something positive. People have finally realized that this is not democracy.
Greece is always called the birthplace of democracy. It is now, even in the limited ruling class sense of the term, it's not representative democracy. At the last parliamentary elections in 2009, the Greek voters had the choice between governing centre-right New Democracy Party, who were pledged to make large cuts, but nothing like on the scale we've seen since, and the centre-left PASOK under George Papandreou, who were maintaining that there was no need for large cuts at that time. Once they got in, as we know, Papandreou came in and made almost all the enormous cuts we've been talking about so far. So it was as if Labour had beaten the Tories in this country, but clamped down far harder on the working class than the Tories had promised to. But at least they'd had the chance to be betrayed by the politicians. They'd had the chance to, in a very limited liberal way, say, I want candidate A to administrate capitalism for me rather than candidate B. And if candidate A had gone further than candidate B said they would, that's just capitalism as usual, really. Then at a crucial point last summer, after huge protests on the streets of Athens and other cities, Papandreou decided that he wanted to hold a referendum on the latest bailout package. He was summoned to meet Sarkozy of France and Merkel of Germany, who demanded that not only he step back from holding a referendum, essentially because they knew they'd lose it, but also that he had to resign. So on the orders of Sarkozy, Merkel and the Troika bankers, Papandreou was replaced by an unelected technocrat, as he was labelled in the media, but in fact he was another top banker who had been the head of the Greek central bank before and had worked with the European Union. Essentially, the Troika had appointed one of their own to do their bidding. Until recently, it was expected that there would be new parliamentary elections at the end of April. However, as the opinion polls stand, the extreme left parties would win enough seats between them to have a significant role in the next government. So far, these left parties have posed as opponents of the austerity agenda, even though I would say we have reason to doubt their word, as they are strongly linked to the trade unions which have helped implement austerity so far. However, it seems certain that the bankers will only allow the left parties to take part in the new government if they make a public statement supporting continued austerity, which, from their own point of view, if they did that before the election, could cost them the election. However, they wouldn't get a chance to be in the next government unless they agreed to do the international bankers' bidding, so they're going to have to make a choice at some point. Recently, the Greek military has also been making its presence felt, especially over the last 6 months or so, holding protests of their own, which is extremely unusual, and appearing alongside the president when he's denounced European politicians from other countries. So a military coup and dictatorship certainly can't be ruled out, especially as the Greek military has ruled over the country in relatively recent decades and could step in at any moment if they feel their interests are threatened.
Control of your destiny. You do look at the state in a very different view, because as soon as you start resisting practically, at some point you will find the state trying to, you know, repress you. Quite positive in that sense. If this attack on people's living standards, so-called crisis, which is basically a total attack, succeeds without us, you know, us, I mean, people being able to stop it, then the picture will be much darker. I can imagine a serious, you know, kind of a neo-fascism coming back into many places. As a matter of fact, the party that's now in government in Spain, the Conservative Party, comes straight, is a straight line from fascist Spain, from Franco time. Obviously now, instead of wearing a military uniform, they have designer clothes. The structure of that party is still the fascist structures. Another example is Hungary. Hungary got a neo-fascist government in power, which has come up with a new constitution that they wrote and they passed within a week, which bans, outright ban on strikes. Not legal to strike in Hungary anymore. Unemployed people are forced to work free, but they are forced to work for free in war camps. It comes with fences around. So unemployed people in Hungary, for example, or a lot of them are Roma.
It could go one of two ways. Either the austerity will continue indefinitely for the foreseeable future, for the next 15 years, like they were talking about the recession, with Greek people more and more desperate to live in more and more dire poverty, unemployment increasing exponentially, prices increasing exponentially, taxes increasing exponentially. Or at some point, the Greek working class has got to fight back and say, enough is enough. We didn't cause this crisis. It was the bankers and politicians, and we're not going to pay for this crisis. If they're going to do that, they've got to act independently of the trade unions and take power into their own hands directly and democratically in workplaces and neighborhoods.
Excellent. Okay, so that was Adam Ford that you heard last, blogger with infantile disorder, and the lovely Spanish voice, or the Spanish accented voice that you heard, that was Mackie.
Oh, he's lovely.
He is lovely. I'd say all the people that we spoke to are lovely. He's an indie reporter and general mover and shaker in the London scene. And then the Irish folk, that was Dissident Ireland.
It was Dissident Ireland talking to people from the Worker Solidarity Movement in Dublin.
Cool.
So, yeah, thanks to everyone who spoke to us.
Yeah, and just to give you an idea of some of the themes we were reflecting upon, one was discussing the aim of the recovery from the crisis of capital in Europe, looking at how the distribution of wealth is being affected by state and superstate control, what kinds of capitalism are emerging from the ashes of this so-called crisis, and how the relationship between citizen and state is changing as a result.
Hmm. I think one of the most interesting things that came out of that for me anyway was Mackie's kind of questioning of the very idea of the crisis, that, you know, we've pretty much swallowed a whole, the idea that there's this crisis and something needs to be done.
Austerity is the buzzword, dude.
Yeah, but it's kind of like it's not so much as being manufactured, but it's definitely been used as a lever to remove the final vestiges of the welfare state from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Greece, Ireland, Italy, Spain are the pointy end of the stick, and Portugal as well. But, like, we can see it in the UK as well, especially with what's happening with the NHS and even the fat police are being privatised, you know.
And I think one of the questions for me out of this is the place of the radical and revolutionary left, because it seems that I include myself in that grouping, we're being pushed into this situation where we're struggling to defend the tiny little real estate of, you know, human integrity that we have. So the health services that are being privatized across Europe and the UK included. But then that ends up being an incredibly reformist kind of position to have to take to try and defend the little that you have vis-a-vis what's been fought for by people over the past centuries. And so I just feel like there's a certain level of paralysis in the radical left in terms of, like,
do you not think, though, that the stripping down of hard-earned rights for the last century should be not... I know it's not, but you would think that would be, like, a bit of a kick up the arse of the radical left to put forward a more radical stance, and that just doesn't seem to be happening out there.
You look at Greece, just through necessity, people are being forced into self-organisation. Like, the other month, there was doctors took over occupied and started to run their own hospital.
Same in Spain as well, Mackie was saying.
And then, like, there's kind of non-monetary economies are emerging in Greece, where, like, barter systems and things like the EQs that the...
EQ?
Do you know the Transition Town movement? Their coin, their system of very local currency that you can't accumulate debt or credit. I mean, those sort of things are actually becoming useful in everyday life in a way that they wouldn't have during a time of, prosperity.
Hmm.
So, I mean, interesting things are emerging, but it's been forced on people just through, like, the need to survive. And
do you see that as being something positive that's coming out of it?
I mean, you can't really say there's anything positive coming out of Greece at the minute. Yeah. It's a fucking terrible state they're in. But, philosophically, it's interesting, some of the things that are happening. And there's a lot of scary shit happening as well in Greece. Like, I think the... the whole political landscape across Europe and the world has been increasingly polarized. Like the middle ground, this whole kind of social democratic middle ground that existed in Europe has just been hollowed out, mm-hmm. so that we end up with fringes of hard left and hard right. Mm-hmm. The left can obviously just can't get its act together. The right seems a lot better at organizing and consolidating power.
Yeah, well, it always has. Anyways.
But just the last word on this, don't forget, 31st of March is the European Day of Action Against Capitalism.
What can we do?
You can go out and say, capitalism bad on the 31st of March.
You can check out the website, which is march31.net. You can also listen to the interview that we did with those cats because they're super smart and it sounds like an interesting thing to get involved in.
Yeah, but it's kind of the start of maybe some interest and means of resistance. Definitely not the end, but hopefully some interest and stuff will come out of it.
Start something new.
Yeah.
Cool.
So we listened to a couple of, bit of music.
We'll have a tune.
Yeah.
Tune.
Yeah, who are we going to play for us next, dude?
Going to hear a song called, song by Wild Bell. How's it going? So that was Wild Bell with Keep You, I believe is the name of the song. We're now in the studio with Joe.
Hey, Joe, dude.
Hello.
So Joe, you're going to kind of you're an anti-fascist and also a huge enthusiast about the kind of ins and outs of the history of anti-fascism in the UK. Yeah,
I am. Yeah, I have a little bit of a sad obsession.
Bit of a history thing.
Yeah, a bit of a history thing. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's better than fucking trains or something. You know, like.
Cool. So, do you maybe just want to give us a brief idea of what, like, the anti-fa movement is for you, to begin with, perhaps?
Anti-fa basically is a kind of abbreviation of a German word which stands for anti-fascism, basically standing against, well, seeing fascism as a class issue, as fundamentally opposed to any kind of working class progressive movements, as anti-democratic, generally uses racism as a means to achieve its goals, as seeing something that's quite definitely anti-trade union, anti-working class organization, upholding the ruling class status quo, and definitely kind of, if you, you can look at it in terms of like an extension of capitalism, essentially, when it's in danger, you definitely see historically there is the ruling classes will definitely adopt fascism and kind of side with fascist groups.
So it's kind of quite quite closely linked to a lot of populism as well, though, because it is like fascism is quite strongly a working class tradition as well. Like
it certainly has a working class base, and it always has, because the working class generally make the majority of population, so it has to appeal to most of the people. And the way it does that is by scapegoating, essentially, and blaming usually kind of minority groups, whether they be ethnic or others, about kind of society's problems. So in 1930s Germany, you saw kind of unemployment being based or being blamed on the Jews, essentially, as the Jews run the banks, the Jews run the government. It's the reason that the Germans didn't win World War One because of the Jews. And there's no kind of, obviously, no kind of like anti-capitalist critique. And you see kind of like the Nazi Party was essentially originally kind of Nationalist Socialist Workers' Party. But it was never pro-working class, never, and never will be, essentially.
You were just talking about Germany there, but, I mean, my earliest knowledge about really sort of fascism is comes from Italy. And, I mean, some of the stuff I was looking at and some of the stuff I've read, like, talks about that in Italy, fascism wasn't actually racist to begin with. No. It's something that came along later, so... Yeah. But since, I suppose, like... Nazi Germany took on that slant, and that then led to Mussolini taking on the same slant.
I mean, what you got to think about is that Nazism or National Socialism as an ideology is a strand of fascism. There's a general misconception that every fascist is a National Socialist. That is absolutely not the case. As you point out, in Italy, the origins of fascism weren't necessarily based on race. That's something that came with the Nazis, this massive biological influence of the kind of the pure Aryan warrior type, quote-unquote, people. That's why, as Antifa and as anti-fascists, that we look at fascism in terms of a class issue as opposed to a race issue. Because theoretically, you can have a fascist party that isn't racist. Theoretically, that is possible. Up until this case, most fascist parties and groups have adopted some form of racism as a means to achieve their end goals.
Well, I guess it's quite an easy way of splitting up people. Like, you know, you can play people off
each other. Divide and rule, essentially,
So, like, moving on then to the UK, like, what do you think the earliest iteration of fascism in the UK is? Would it be Mosley, or would you trace it back to things before?
I'm sure you could trace it back to things before. My kind of, like, view of kind of the first fascists and the first fascist groups would be more kind of Mosley and the British Union of Fascists, who were active in the pre-war, World War II years. I suppose the most famous anti-fascist battle of all was the Battle of Cable Street in 1936, which took place about 2 minutes behind.
Our local historical.
It was very, very local, yeah. It just took place in Cable Street, which is only 2 minutes away from us. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, the BUF were classic fascists. I mean, it's hard to see that nowadays. You won't get people who were... who openly claim to be fascists nowadays.
And, like, would you, what kind of box would you put them in? Because, like, they came down to this part of the world because Whitechapel used to be a predominantly Jewish neighbourhood. Yeah. But, like, do you think that fascism in the UK or Britain would have that racist tinge that, like, National Socialism has, or would it be more kind of, let's say, purely fascist, as in the kind of the Italian tradition?
Well, historically, I mean, the British Union of Fascists were racist. They were anti-Semitic. I mean, that was one of their major pulls, was that they were highly anti-Semitic, even after the Second World War, and when the images of Auschwitz and Belsen and all the concentration camps were kind of coming out to the British public in the form of newsreels. Even then, they maintained that not enough Jews were killed and that we should get rid of the Jews and that the Jews control the government, the media and the banking system and that all the problems are down to the Jews. So the BUF, the British Union of Fascists, were always very, very anti-Semitic. And I'd say they kind of, yeah, in a sense, they did take a lot from Mussolini and Italian-style fascism, but they also inherited a lot from the Nazis as well.
So, I mean, that's actually a bit of a grey patch for me. Like, what happened to fascism in Britain after the Second World War? I mean, did it just die off? Or?
No, it certainly didn't. Actually, it rejuvenated completely. Many of the fascists during the Second World War were in prison, because of the war. Mm-hmm. After that finished, the British Union of Fascists kind of came about again, and several other small kind of fascist cells and groups started to reform. And what you had was basically, even in this area in East London, what you had was every single week, you know, sometimes two or three times a week, what you'd find is fascist speakers on platforms in the street, doing street meetings and spouting out anti-Semitic terms and philosophy, and talking about kind of like basically advocating fascism, you know, and they were much more open back then. They were clearly anti-democratic. They didn't try and hide that, unlike now, which is much more nuanced. But
so around about that time, I suppose, is when anti-fascism came around. Do you want to give us an idea about how that kind of started?
Yeah, basically, the first kind of organised anti-fascist group ever in the UK, well, in England primarily, was the 43 group, which was formed out of predominantly ex-Jewish servicemen who just came back, literally just a few months before, came back from fighting in World War II, and they came back to the streets of predominantly East London, and they came back to the streets and found that the same people they had been fighting for were the same people who were, sorry, the same people they were fighting against, yeah, were the same people who were actually spouting the anti-Semitic views, the fascist views, and these guys were on the streets, and they were, you know, as you can imagine, incredibly, you know, pissed off, if you like. As I said before, this was exactly a time when the newsreels of Auschwitz, you know, the actual pictures of, you know, millions of people just like bodies treated like they're crap, like they're scum, they're not even human, just being piled onto each other. These pictures were coming back, and obviously as Jews, as British Jews, they felt very strongly about this, and they just couldn't allow it. They couldn't have it, basically, that fascists were on the streets shouting the same slogans that Nazis were.
Did they start to organize as groups at that point?
Yeah.
Was that throughout England and Scotland and Wales,
Or is it mostly throughout England? To an extent, London was definitely the heart of it. The 43 group organised mainly because the name 43 group derives from the fact that there were 43 people at their first meeting, and they were the first militant anti-fascist group. So their aim was basically and purely to smash the fascists off the street. So every time there was a street meeting or a private meeting, or whether there was propaganda being distributed, they would basically go there, basically beat the crap out of them. Yeah, essentially that's what they did. I mean, you've got to remember, some of these guys were ex-paratroopers, ex-Royal Marines, right? These were elite military people, and they smashed the fascists off the street. And I'd give them wholehearted credit to the fact that they pretty much destroyed the British Union of Fascists during that period. The radical difference between them and kind of 70s, 80s and 90s anti-fascists was that the 43 group was strictly apolitical. That means anybody could join. It didn't have any left-wing or right-wing political ideologies, unlike the latter anti-fascists, which were strictly left-wing, either socialist-based or anarchist-based.
Okay. Well, let's have a track now, and when we come back, we'll talk about like the kind of more recent struggles between fascism and anti-fascism. So this is Top Cat versus Daddy Buzz. Big up yourself, Daddy Buzz. Hope it's sunny where you are. Switch the master weapon. This is the roughest and roughest gunner over the deck at the top. Hear this, watch out. We are the roughest gunner from out the suburb. Any boy says we have a job of God first. Roughest gunner from out the suburb. Any boy says we have a job of God first. We have a Joe and little straight Al.
Yeah, Al. Hey, Al. Man.
Hello.
Hiya. So, yeah, we were talking there about kind of the...
Hang on. That was... Who would you say that was playing? It was Deadly Buzz and...
Deadly Buzz versus Top Cat.
Cool.
What was the name of the song? The name of the song was Rufus Gunark VIP. Binary Feedback Master 1.3, apparently. So, yeah, we were talking there before the song about kind of fascism in the 1940s, kind of pre and post Second World War. But I guess the next big moment in this kind of struggle was the emergence of the National Front. Yeah. So,
who the fuck are the National Front?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Oh, well, the National Front are a bunch of fucking cunts, but never mind. They describe themselves as a white nationalist organisation. Essentially, they are a bunch of neo-Nazis, if you like.
How did they spring up? Where are they?
Well, they come from the 60s and 70s, really. But, I mean, I suppose the part that I'm more interesting is there the actual opposition to them in the 70s. And that came through the kind of creation of what was termed as the squads. And the squads actually, I know it might be hard to believe, but actually came from the SWP. And they were set up as defense squads initially, mainly because the SWP stalls and other socialist stalls were continuously attacked by the National Front. Eventually, this kind of organization kind of became slightly autonomous and kind of decided that attack was the best form of defense. And now the SWP didn't really like that, and so ended up actually expelling all the squad members from the SWP, and they went on to form Red Action, which then continued to bring the fight against the National Front in a militant anti-fascist way. I mean, they were physically and ideologically opposed to any form of fascism, but in this case, it was specifically the National Front. And during the 80s, what you saw was the formation of Anti-Fascist Action, which again was this sort of a umbrella-type group, which included many militant or anti-fascist organizations, such as Red Action being the largest in many parts, the Direct Action Movement, which was the old Solfed, the anarcho-syndicalist group, class war were involved until a certain period, and then many other kind of smaller groups and individuals were also involved in anti-fascist action. And anti-fascist action was basically one of the best anti-fascist organizations we've ever seen in this country, essentially. I mean, they were basically smashing the fascists up and down this country, both in a physical manner and an ideological manner. They had many carnivals, they held kind of school trips where they go into kind of schools and talk about fascism, and they would they weren't just a physical group.
Anti-fascist action, but what about where the UAF? What's the deal with them?
Well, in terms of when anti-fascist action were active, they weren't called the UAF. They were called the Anti-Nazi League, which is basically exactly the same as the UAF. Essentially, they were a kind of liberal / lefty, trendy lefty type of anti-fascism, completely different from the likes of anti-fascist action, Antifa, or Red Action, where they kind of advocate some sort of liberal, for non-violent form of anti-fascism. And as you'd expect, seeing as they're quite non-violent, they seem to get attacked by the far right a lot without much consequence. So yeah, I mean, they're completely, basically, the major difference between militant anti-fascism, which would be the likes of AFA, Red Action, 43 Group and Antifa, and the likes of the liberal anti-fascism wing, which would be more Anti-Nazi League and UAF, is a tactical question, which is the question of the use of violence and the use of force, and an ideological question where they would see fascism as essentially a race issue as opposed to a class issue, which is what anarchists and socialists and militant anti-fascist kind of line would be.
Mm-hmm. And so then was there some sort of watershed moment in the fight against the National Front where they just all hung up their jackboots, or how did it end?
It's quite a complicated question in terms of how did it exactly end. I mean, AFAS and Red Action certainly put the pressure on the streets, causing them to basically make it much harder for them to organise openly on the streets. However, it is widely accepted that in the 1979 general election, that the reason the National Front did so badly and eventually split was because Thatcher basically adopted many of their policies, leading many kind of much of the public support for the National Front into the Tories, especially with the whole kind of like anti-immigration kind of aspect as well. And so that was recognised as one of the main downfalls of the National Front. But also physically, they were put to the test essentially to be able to organise in the street without any sort of opposition. So, you know, they were given a hard time basically. Mm-hmm.
And then I guess kind of moving on to the present day, we've seen a re-emergence of a different kind, but nonetheless equally kind of odious form of fascism, or whatever you're going to call it, with the EDL. I mean, it's a very much a street level presence.
It is, yeah. But there's one thing to bear in mind as well when you're talking about kind of 21st century fascism and anti-fascism, is that things have become much more nuanced than they were. The national organizations like the National Front were much more open about their beliefs. The likes of the EDL are much more complicated. It's not good enough to just shout Nazi scum off our streets at them, mainly because the vast majority, the 90% majority of them, aren't National Socialists. Mm-hmm. And so it looks ridiculous when you shout Nazi scum off our street.
It's theoretically
incorrect, yeah.
Is that what they shout back?
they probably do. But, you know, you, it, 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 because the EDL is much more nuanced, it really, you have to look at them politically. They are obviously Islamophobic and they have many nationalistic tendencies. And within them, there are lots of kind of fascistic sympathies. And you especially see that coming through with their splinter groups, like the Northwest Infidels, the Northeast Infidels. I was like 2 days ago, I was on the Northeast Infidels Facebook page, and their status was bring back Hitler's final solution for Muslims, put them in a swimming pool with a big hole and pour petrol over them and burn them. Right. Obviously, that's much more openly fascistic, and in fact their slogan is more racist, more violent, so that kind of gives you an idea of the quality of people that are in that group.
To be honest, though, sorry, I mean, we're talking about fascism here, that's just overt racism. What is it about them do you think that makes them fascists? Or is...
If you read the Northeast or any of the infidels Facebook pages descriptions, that what they describe themselves is exactly what the NF would describe themselves, exactly what the BUF would describe themselves. They are anti-working class, anti-Irish republicanism, which is often being a target of the far right. They are extremely racist. They are pretty much anti-democratic. They are much more traditionally and classically fascist based, but with also a neo-Nazi kind of edged them with the whole racism part, basically.
So, I mean, I guess briefly, tactically, how do you engage with this newer form of fascism?
Well, as militant anti-fascists, with two fundamental principles, and that is physical and ideological opposition to fascism. Now, the physical side of things, it's got to be relative to the situation. And so in the past, the use of physical force was used against groups that also used physical force, and that was one of the main reasons why it came about. With the likes of the infidels and the splinter groups from the EDL, they are much more violent and much more prepared to use violence. They are quite organized, and so it is possibly necessary to use violence in defense, and even so in attack. However, we should always maintain our ideological opposition to fascism and actually go out there and talk to white working class people who are feeling disillusioned with mainstream politics, and they feel that their only way is the far right, and we have to tell them, and we have to go there and actually just talk to them, really engage with them and say, look, these people aren't your answer for any of your short-term, medium-term or long-term solutions, that these people are inherently anti-working class, inherently anti-progressive, and then they're just not the solution, really.
Mm-hmm. So aside from being friends with the Northeast infidels on Facebook, what is the best way to kind of engage in this anti-fascist struggle? Like, do Antifa have open meetings, or are there groups that you could recommend that people kind of hang about if they're interested in this sort of thing?
Well, first and foremost, Antifa doesn't necessarily exist in this country anymore for several reasons. However, it is hard to engage in kind of militant anti-fascism because often many of the activities are illegal. And so it does have a tendency to become a bit clandestine or semi-clandestine. However, what you can do is engage in the ideological side. If there isn't an opportunity to engage with an anti-fascist group, you can organise in your community. Even doing stuff like anti-capitalist or anti-cuts work is inherently anti-fascist. And it is something that all the fascists will disagree with. And they might give you a hard time if there are fascists in your area. But the key is to organise as a community and as a class, ultimately, that is the real anti-fascist struggle right there.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for coming
in, man. Thanks, dude.
Thank you.
It's been a very interesting discussion, and hopefully there's some happy chapters to come. So we're going to listen to a track from Fuck, who played at our party last weekend.
Bad Sector label.
Bad Sector. Thanks for... And he's going to be playing on the 4th of May, which is... You've got a while to wait, but, you know, I'm sure you can hang on.
It's our 100th episode tonight. So we brought in a very special guest for this evening. All the way from the US of A.
Thank you and good evening.
As it's our 100th episode, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, well, the last 4.5 years, you know, that's how long it's been running. It's a long time for a project of this nature. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about what it is that binds the group together, that, you know, gives it that collective nature and, you know, enables us to work together so much.
Drugs and alcohol.
Yeah. It's hard to argue with that, really, you know.
So thanks to Neil for that.
Yeah, cheers, dude. Hang on. It's for you, dude. Thanks very much.
So sitting with us here now, we have Pete L. Temp.
Hello.
How's it going?
Hi. Hello.
Welcome back.
Hello, yes. Nice to be back here in the basement, underground, where we belong, like rats in a cellar.
Okay. Well, I think the last time you were with us, we were overground.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
No, neither did we.
I like being in cold, damp places. Not that this is cold and damp, but, you know.
No, warm and damp.
It's a bit damp, though, dude, honestly.
Okay, fair enough. Just a beer that spilled on the floor, isn't it? You guys, I don't know.
Okay.
Yes, nice.
So, how have you been?
I've been well, yeah. Today I was in Bedford. Lovely town of Bedford.
Go you, man. How was it?
Oh, it's very nice. I was with Simon Munnery, the stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And we were working on my show, my stage show, yes. And he's a genius. He's a comic genius. And it was lovely to get his touch on the scripts, basically. You know, he's awesome.
Tell us about your show.
Leads in quite nicely, doesn't it? A little plug.
Very
I don't mind if
question.
I do. My one-man multimedia poetry roadshow is called Pete the Temp versus Climate Change versus, you get the pun there, it's a spoken word show, poetry show, in it I single-handedly defeat the monster of climate change using only my mouth.
Yeah. No. A lot of sucking or a lot of blowing, dude.
It could be the most conceited thing that anybody's ever done.
Wish you well.
I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down like Hurricane Katrina.
But then you'll only need to do the show once.
Yes, come and
it'll be in Bedford.
It's going to be the end of the world. And that's going to be the 3rd of May.
Mm-hmm. Is it safe to say there's a lot of hot air?
Oh, he did that! It's going in the show, Patrick! It's going in the show!
I want a cut.
You want a cut?
Yeah.
You can have a cut of all of my riches.
All your riches.
Currently, my balance is in debt, so you're more than welcome to it.
Yeah. Fair enough. Cool. And so do you have some material with you from your show, or what's going on?
I could do a little poem. I could do a poem for you. Yeah.
We would like that, dude.
Okay, this is a little bit from a poem called The Texas Chain Store Massacre, and it goes like this. There's a worldwide movement that's growing like bindweed through the rotting flower bed of industrial greed. Through the hardened ground of this corporate winter, there's an unexpected item in the bagging area. Cultivated Cuban allotment plots, landless peasants of the Amazon basin, rooftop gardens of Colombian slums, millions and millions of Indian peasantry seizing back land and with it democracy. No WTO, no GMO, no to Monsanto and biotechnology. Unlicensed restaurants of New York City, clandestine markets of central Italy. This is biopiracy in the right direction. Counterinsurgency seeds breed from the plottings of guerrilla gardeners that seek to weave a green mosaic into the fabric of this concrete metropolis, whose pockets of growth seized and squatted turn towns into edible landscapes. This processed food for thought's got us thinking globally, and so we start to eat locally. We will be free range again, not battery humans, but locavores. McWorkers of the world, unite. We have nothing to lose but our chain stores. What's underground will come to fruition if we water the seeds of our own ambition. People, supermarkets, food banks, soup kitchens, fertile soil for urban employment. Welcome to free-range Britain, checking out of conveyor belt treadmill consumption. Welcome to free-range Britain, checking out of conveyor belt treadmill consumption. The revolution will not be microwaved, freeze-dried, shrink-wrapped, packaged in plastic packaging, because eating is an ecological action and that makes my plate political. So I'll eat the change that I wish to see, one meal at a time. Thank you.
Nice. Woo! Woo!
Poetry.
I'm really surprised you managed to do that sitting down. You're quite animated.
I guess, yeah, I'm like a monkey in a cage sometimes. I just want to explode all over the face of this city. But, you know, this year, it's all going to happen, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? It's going to have a view, it's going to have this place.
Are you talking about the Mayans?
The Mayans, yes. Oh, the Mayans.
They say it's all happened this year, too.
No, but I really think so. This year, do you know what I mean? We're going to build our Blakean utopia at Jerusalem in what's left of the green bits of this pleasant land. And do you know? And I think, you know, the Olympics are going to be here. And I'm going to get on my soapbox. You know, I've just done a poem now. If there was a soapbox, I'd be standing on it, right? We've got the Olympics and all of the energy and all of the focus of the world's attention is going to be on this city. And we're going to have the chance to set the parameters of the debate on all the shit that's going down. And big up you guys, and big up Lark, and big up the squatting movement and the Occupy movement and Sunrise Festival and Shambhala and Small World and all the people who are doing beautiful things and got beautiful things planned. Do you know what I mean? Because first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they attack you, and at the moment they're attacking us and they're trying to make what we're doing illegal, and then we win! Yay! Woo! Yay!
One step from victory, yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, sweet. So while you're on the subject of bigging up people, we've got a few people we want to big up ourselves. So there's the people who aren't with us just now, starting with Proximity.
Oh, you worked this out, actually. All right. Well, I'd say
maybe Adam.
Adam.
Then Eugenio. Then Bryn. Then
I'm going to say Aggers. Then Neil.
Then Anya.
And I'll tack Dan on there as well.
And Dan, yo Dan.
Yeah. There's also big shout outs go to Hooja Fink and the Binary Feedback crew.
Sunday Sounds is on this Sunday.
In the Rat Cave in Camberwell.
Ooh, deadly place, buzz along.
Solar powered sounds for your Sunday. Big up Maddie, big up Lena.
Yeah. Hey G babe.
Can I go with my private list?
Yeah, no. And obviously,
but you're making it public now.
Well, I just wanted to say as well, big up to the whole crew and everything we did the party with last week. That's Siren, Recknaw, and ASS.
Yeah, the party was awesome.
Yeah, no, it was dead. Everyone was very cool. So, yeah, nice one to light you up yourselves.
Good stuff. I'd like to big up the kids from the 1 in 12 in Bradford. So, Dunk, Protag, Jen, Jim Dog. I'd also like to big up the Hate Labists for our awesome fucking new website.
Yeah, everyone's looking around confused because anyone who knows us doesn't look at it. But you should check out the website, man. Oh, it's
actually worth looking at now.
Yeah, disadnown.org.
And I'd like to also say thank you to Mackie, Cactus U, and Startex, Usari, and Mara, GDM, Picona and Ionic for supporting this project in the past 4.5 years. And thanks to everyone who's ever been on the show and everyone who listens.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, dude.
Christmas past and Christmas future.
Yeah.
Oh, and Grow Heathrow. Big them up to.
Yeah.
Lively up yourselves.
The show. Yeah, Dissonant Island, 100 years old.
We do it slightly more than once a year.
And then, of course, there's the Spaces as well. There's Rampart, Ballcourt.
Mare Street.
Various incarnations of Mare Street, actually.
The Mare Street crew.
Then Lark. Let's not forget Lark.
Yeah, big up Lark and users and groups that have been involved in the past and the present and, I guess, the future.
Yeah. So, going to have a brief jingle to remind you who you're listening to, and then we're going to listen to DJ Warlock. So thanks for listening to our 100th episode.
Big up Dissident Island! Yeah!
Yeah!
You're listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Oh, yeah.
www.dissidentsisland.org. I'm sorry. I'm a panic. for